again. I would like to introduce to everyone here members of Lincoln High School of Wisconsin Rapids. Could these students from Lincoln High please stand up? Good. Well, welcome. You may be seated. We're the third group of students we've had today, and we want to welcome you. These students are here with a national award-winning program that the court runs with the State Bar called Court with Class. And now that we've met you, I would like to introduce the court to you. On my far left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and I believe you met with him at noon. And to his right is Justice Jeanine Geske. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. My immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right is Justice John Wilcox. And to the far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With those introductions made, we will proceed to our case, 96-2511. Borneman versus Corwin Transport. Representing Corwin Transport is Jeffrey Strand.
Your Honor, counsel, good afternoon. My name is Jeff Strand, and I represent the defendants in this action, Corwin Transport, and its insurance carrier, Great West Casualty Company. On September 26, 1994, Jason Borneman, an employee of Major Industries, died in an industrial accident at his place of employment. His widow brought the instant action against my clients, asserting that Jason Borneman died as a result of the negligent acts of Monty Sisdell, an employee of Corwin Transport. Sisdell denies that he was negligent or otherwise responsible for Jason Borneman's death. Were this the end of the story, we would not be here today. The case would simply be one of comparative negligence left to a judge or jury to decide. We assert, however, that Monty Sisdell was a special employee of Major Industries, and as a consequence, a co-employee of Jason Borneman at the time of Mr. Borneman's death. As a result, Mrs. Borneman's exclusive remedy for the death of her husband lies in the benefits available to her under the Wisconsin Workers' Compensation Act. The trial court agreed and dismissed this action. The Court of Appeals reversed, however, holding that Sisdell did not meet the requirements of the lone employee test used to interpret both the exclusive remedy provisions of the Wisconsin Workers' Compensation Act and the so-called borrowed servant rule. The Court of Appeals did not, however, reach that conclusion under a proper application of the lone employee test, as adopted by this court more than 65 years ago. Instead, the Court of Appeals drafted its own test, substantially modifying and adding to the requirements of the loaned employee test, concluding that as it could not find a formal contractual relationship between Corwin Transport and Major Industries, and between Sisdell and Major Industries, with regard to Sisdell's work at Major Industries, Sisdell was quite simply not a loaned employee, and as a consequence, neither the exclusive remedy provision nor the borrowed servant rule apply. The primary issue before this court is fairly straightforward. Does the loaned employee test, as an adjunct to the borrowed servant rule and the exclusive remedy provisions of the Wisconsin Workers' Compensation Act, require that a new formal employment contract be created between management for a general employer and management for a special employer before the employee may be deemed a loaned employee? The Court of Appeals held that it does. We assert that it does not, and further that the Court of Appeals decision holding to the contrary is directly contrary to longstanding precedent in this state and of this court.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. Let me ask you, under that precedent, what is your position as to whether or not the general employer has to have knowledge of the loaned employee situation?
The case law does not speak directly to that issue. there is, or was, an argument raised by the Court of Appeals that there has to be a contract formed between the general and the special. That would imply, obviously, that the general would have pre-knowledge.
I'm obviously arguing, asking you about something less than a formal agreement, but at least knowledge of the situation. And my question is, under the case law that you've described, Seaman and the rest of the cases, whether or not at least knowledge would be required, that the general employer knew that its employee was being loaned and acting as a special employee of another employer.
I don't believe the case law addresses it, but my opinion is no. The reason I take that opinion is this, especially in a case such as the one before this court, we have a situation in which the employee in question is not on the employment premises of his general employer. He'd been sent on a mission, on a one-man mission, as it were, to basically pick up a trailer and transport it. He's not in a position for the general employer to have foreknowledge. In those cases in Wisconsin which have addressed this issue, at least on the fringes, it's always been very simple because there's always been a, not always, but in most cases, there's been a direction by the general employer to the employee to go work for the special employer.
So in all the cases, there's been knowledge and maybe even direction or at least an implied agreement?
I don't know that I would go that far, Your Honor, for this reason. There's at least one case in Wisconsin, and again, I'm not sure why this is. In the Northern Trust Company case, which is granted a bit aged, it's a 1939 decision, the case involved a manager of one farm who went to work for the manager or went to work on another farm. The court in that case basically said the owner of the farm didn't know that its manager had left, didn't know that its manager had gone over to work, and there was no pre-arrangement. Now, there had been acts in the past, but there's no indication in this case that the employer had any knowledge whatsoever that this was going on in this instance. And again, it's a one-time factual situation we have in our case, so it's somewhat difficult to say.
Let me ask you, would you concede that there's no evidence in this record that Cohen knew that its employee was working to assist a major in loading the truck?
In this instance, yes.
Okay.
I would assert that the record has references to prior acts with other employers. In other words, that it wasn't uncommon in the industry for a driver to assist in the loading of vehicles. That happened.
And that's what my question would be, that this is an industry, the trucking business, where it isn't like a banking business, farming business, or any other business, where you typically would be going to pick up, I mean, you drop a load off, you drop the trailer off, and then you're, as in this case, you're told to come back at 10:30 or 2 weeks from now or whatever. So it seems to me that unless there's, it would be a surprise to the employer that there would be, quote, a relationship. That would be because the driver would look at the, he would look at the load and say, you know, I can't drive that load down the road because it looks, it's not properly loaded. Does he become, he or she then become an employer of, in this case, major, because they even made a suggestion, or as Justice Geske's asking, shouldn't there be some knowledge, something between the employee and his employer? Because this is a trucking business is definitely, I think, kind of a special situation where the driver is always off, well, generally off premises. And that's what you do. You pick up loads and you haul them to some other place.
Actually, Your Honor, I think I would argue for the reverse in this case. I think it's vitally important, the fact that the employer didn't know that this was going on. The question, the overall question that this court is addressing is who should be responsible for the acts of Monty Sisdall. That's the question that underlies everything else this court is going to decide. The employer, Corwin Transport, only knew that it sent its employee to pick up a trailer and then to drive that trailer to Georgia. It did not intend to, nor did it ever expect that its employee would begin loading a trailer. In fact, everyone agrees that the contractual situation here was such that it was solely the responsibility of major industries to load the trailer. So in a case like this, Your Honor, I would assert that it's just to the opposite, that it is vitally important that the employer didn't know about this, that it was a surprise to them that CISTL was engaged in this activity, and that as a result, if anyone should bear responsibility for CISTL's acts, it should be the party that used him, received the benefits from his employment, and controlled and directed his employment.
Well, one of the questions that are asked under the Siemens test is whose was the right to control the detail of the work being performed? Mm-hmm. How would you answer that question in this case?
There is no question that the right to control the details of the work being performed was in the hands of major industries. Major industries had the contract to load the trailer.
Is it undisputed in this record that Major was in fact controlling CISTL?
I believe so. The only testimony to the contrary, if it is to the contrary, was testimony by interestingly enough, a temporary employee of Major Industries from a temporary help agency, who indicated that he had overheard some comments from Monty CISTL of, let's shift this in tighter or let's move this in tighter so that it would fit.
Let me ask you something. Procedurally, the trial court decided summary judgment one way. The Court of Appeals, as I understand it, reversed that and found summary judgment saying that the other way. Might there not be a middle ground that there's some factual issues that a fact finder would have to determine in order to determine whether or not the lone employee defense prevails here?
No, I do not believe so, Your Honor. Again, the only issue in dispute, if there is one, is just these offhand comments. And the issue of control is more than just did the special employee or the alleged special employee make offhand comments. It's a question of who had control of the work. Interestingly enough, the statute, which this court has seen fit to interpret on a couple of occasions in the last couple of years, 102.29 of the statutes concerning temporary help agencies, in defining what a temporary help agency is, uses the phrase control of the activity, control of the, in essence, control.
What about control of the employee? Is that part of it? Who has the right to direct and control the employee? Is that part of the test?
That is part of the.
Is your position that Major had the right to tell this employee what to do and what not to do?
Your Honor, the loaned servant test is different than the test under the statute. Under the statute, they're looking more toward who had the right to control this individual. Under the four-part test, they're looking to who had the right to control the detail of the work being done, of the activity being concluded.
So under the Seaman test, it's your position that you don't have to look at who had control of the employee?
Not directly, no. You look to just who controlled the work that was being done. The work here was loading of the vehicle in question.
Mr. Strand?
Yes.
I take it that the employees, whether it was three or four that were on the ground, were not management employees. They did not have the authority to hire or fire. Is that correct?
The gentleman on the truck with Mr. CISTL, Doug Gruzwitz, was a foreman, a working foreman.
But could he hire people?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, assuming that he can't, and I don't... I guess maybe the record doesn't show it, but assuming that he's not a hiring authority, it seems to me that your position is that an employee can unilaterally establish a loaned employee relationship.
Well, Your Honor,
is that your position?
No, that's not my position, because I think Doug Gruzwitz had more authority than that. Whether he's president of the company or whether he's perhaps lowest on the totem pole, a supervisor certainly.
Okay.
I think that is enough.
So your position then is that an employee cannot unilaterally establish it, but so long as only one party knows, i.e., in this instance, it's Major, it's not necessary that his regular employer know.
That would be correct. The statute talks in terms of control. consent by the employee. It doesn't talk in terms of consent by the general employer.
Well, then maybe we need to know whether or not Mr. Brusewitz was in a position to hire, because if he was not in a position to hire, then if you prevail, we would be saying that an employee can unilaterally establish the relationship of willing employee.
In the Bonnefield versus Zell case, Your Honor, the individual in that case that was quote-unquote charged with the activity that created the relationship was a supervisor, was a on-staff, apparently plant supervisor. As far as I can tell, identical to Doug Brusewitz. He may be called a foreman, but he is a supervisor of the crew.
So it's your position that somebody besides the employee needs to be present in order to, and needs to have some kind of authority in order to establish a land employee relationship.
Your Honor, I don't know if that's true or not. It's not applicable to this case. Obviously, the pertinent one is the special employee. That's the one that's most important, because he's the one that the case law refers to in terms of consent. The question then is whether there has to be a relationship formed with someone more than just an employee for the special employer. And I don't know the answer to that question, but I would assert that in a case like this, no. We have three and perhaps four employees from major industries, all of whom used Monty Sisdell. He took the place of one of their employees. He was the fourth man in a four-man team necessary to load these units. Whether there was a specific contract formed before that occurred or during that occurrence, I think is irrelevant. What's really important, especially in this case, is the fact that he started off. We don't know how he started off. That's acknowledged. We know he started working. We don't know if he asked, if he volunteered, if he was asked. No one knows the answer to that question.
Nobody asked Mr. Sisdell that question?
He could not recall. This was sometime after this had occurred, and as you can imagine, the events of that day were rather traumatic, and I suspect it may have affected his some of the recollection in that regard.
Counsel, where do you think the Court of Appeals went astray?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Where do you think the Court of Appeals went astray?
I think they went astray in at least two principal areas. First, they went astray by asserting that there has to be a contract between, arguably, the general and the special employers, and a separate contract between the special employer and the special employee. That would be the first place they went astray. And I think, secondly, they went principally astray with regard to the issue of control. They took the assumption that the control had to be over the man, over the employee. And that's not what the case law refers to. It refers to control over the details of the work to be performed. Those are the two principal areas I would assert that they went astray.
So you don't think there has to be a contract?
I do not believe there. I'm sorry.
Between the special and general. So here you have an employee of Corwin, and he just walks on and decides that he knows best and helps work the detail. That's enough.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure if we're tracking on this. Let me explain what I think we need. We have an underlying contract here. There is a contract between the special and the general employer because they've contracted to all three. I think you need that because otherwise you do have a volunteer situation. Somebody can't just walk in off the street who has no knowledge concerning an organization, begin helping out, and claim that they're suddenly employed by that organization. That would create havoc in a lot of areas of the law. We have, however, that underlying contract, just like we do in the other cases. The question then is, do we need a second contract, or more importantly, do we need a particular clause addressing Mr. Sisdell or the special employee? And I would assert we don't need a written contract.
So I go back to the example I gave you. There's a contract for loading and unloading here. And then the contract's silent as to whether any of the employees of Corwin are going to help out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now we got a Corwin employee who helps out. That's enough.
Well, no, because there is a there are four elements to the test. The first, there has to be consent. Then there has to be control. The question
by
is
by whom?
Excuse me?
Sent by whom?
By the special employee.
Okay.
control over the details of the work by the special employer. So in your example, if the employee walks in and says, okay, I'll control it, I'll tell you what to do, that would be a problem.
Right.
The special employer wouldn't be controlling the details of the work. Thirdly, there has to be, which I don't think is really too much in question here, who is primarily responsible, or who is receiving the primary benefit, and whether the work was being done for one party or the other. In this instance, it's clear that the truck is being loaded. There is a question raised by the Court of Appeals over whether Monty Sisgall had to be working of and for the special employer exclusively at the time that the injury occurred. That is, if I will, the third problem I have with the Court of Appeals decision, this exclusivity rule that they've developed, saying the special employee, if he's going to be one, must be working solely with one or solely for the special employer. The case law is replete with instances in which that's not true, and in fact, this court has said on a number of occasions, in a number of cases, just to the opposite. So that is, I think, blatant error by the Court of Appeals.
Let me tell you what troubles me about your position on this. It seems to me that when you have an employee, the employer has an expectation that the employee's allegiance, the direction that employee takes, the kind of work he or she performs, is all under that employer's gamut of responsibility. And for that employee then to become a quote-unquote loaned employee that is under the direction of some other employer who may have conflicting values or conflicting missions and all sorts of things, and then to say to the original employer, that employee became a loaned employee without your knowledge and consent. That employee then suddenly was under the direction of someone, and you don't even have to have knowledge, or you don't have to consent to it in order to have that person as a loaned employee, seems contradictory to me.
Your Honor, I guess I would go back to the whole basis for the loaned employee test and for the borrowed servant rule and for the exclusivity. This court said back in Scornia, the reason for the rule is to properly allocate the burden and the benefit. We have a gentleman who is working for a general employer. The general employer controls him. He does this, sends him where he's supposed to go. He goes out. He's no longer now under the immediate control of the general employer. That's obvious. He then goes into a new employment relationship. He begins undertaking duties clearly not contracted for with his general employer. He begins doing things that clearly the general employer never expected him to do, and it is alleged as a result of those activities, engages in negligent acts that harm someone, or in this case, results in a death. The question is, who's getting the benefit of his work at that point? Clearly the special employer is getting the benefit of the work. The general employer is not getting any benefit out of this. The question then is, who should bear the risk of that benefit? It should be the special employer, not the general employer. The general employer is out of control. The general employer doesn't know what's happening. The general employer is receiving no benefit. And the special employee has agreed to this new relationship. It's not as if the general employer is throwing him out.
Counsel, I submit that when you focus on those four questions of benefit and control and the other questions, your argument seems to miss B of the Seaman test, which requires that it be an express or implied contract to do so. That's the language. That is, B reads, actual entry by the employee upon the work of and for the special employer. So if you have the employee going to work of the special employer and working for the special employer pursuant to an express or implied contract to do so.
Mm-hmm.
How do you interpret express or implied contract to do so? As between the two employers or between the special employee and special employer?
Well, I think the term express contract is fairly straightforward. That would have to be something in writing, and I interpret that as being between the special employee and the new employer.
If it is interpreted to be between the general employer and the new employer, then your argument fails. Is that correct?
No, that only applies to an express contract.
Well, express or implied contract to do so, says
correct.
The Seaman case. And
Right, one or the other. There is no express contract, if we assume an express contract is something in writing in this case.
An implied contract is an implied contract between, can be interpreted as an implied contract between the two employers to allow the special employee to work for the special employer. And if it's interpreted in that fashion, it seems to me, absent an implied or express contract, there is no loaned employee, and then your position fails.
Well, but I believe there is an implied contract here, Your Honor, in both instances. Number one, there's an implied contract because the employer has not specifically told the employee, don't do anything out there, don't work on the vehicle, don't load the vehicle. So there's no demand that the special employee not participate in the act.
Is there... Again, I return to the words, and the words say actual entry by the employee upon the work of, and let me emphasize, for the special employer. The work done for the special employer pursuant to an express or implied contract to do so. That defines what a loaned employee is.
And there is no question that that's what this loaned employee did. He went in, he began loading a vehicle, and it served only one purpose, that of the special employer. It was the work of the special employer, and it was done for
For the special employer pursuant to an implied contract between the two employers.
Yes.
I thought you conceded that the special employer didn't know. There was no evidence that he was doing.
The question is, what is the term implied contract? The case law in Wisconsin hasn't defined that term insofar as this act is concerned. I think that's when you have to look at the four questions, which really has been kind of adopted as the Seaman test, rather than the three questions which preceded in the case law, or in that case. And if you look to those, what they're principally concerned with, or how they've defined it, is consent by the employee, and secondly, and then the last three tests, if you will, but principally the consent issue. So the question is, in essence, the employee is the one contracting for the employer. The employee says, yes, I will agree to do this. I will go and I will submit to their direction.
So the employee loans himself to the employer?
Yes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for Mr. Bondman.
Good afternoon, Court, opposing counsel. I also have here Terry Bornemann, who is the surviving spouse with some family members and serving on this. I have a presentation that I wanted to do. I know you're answering questions. I think what I'm going to do here at this point is to first get into some areas that were some questions were asked. Hopefully, I can clarify that.
You'll have to stand right in front of that microphone in order for us to record you.
All right, thank you. One of the questions that came up is in the area about arrangements or contracts between the parties and whether it was expressed or implied or whether the parties had actually reached an agreement. And the appellate court said that in virtually every case, there was an arrangement that went on prior to the work being performed. And if you look back on the case law, in the Seaman case, Colander, who was working for the Average Company, telephoned Bauman for the Seaman Company and said, we're short of men, and requested that Bauman send one or two of your sharper hands. And then Bauman told Colander he would, and then he introduced his assistant, who went to see an employee, and they talked about the terms of the employment, and then the employees were instructed to go over them. And you go right on down through all of the cases that are here, not virtually all of them, but every single case, you have knowledge and you have consent that is going on between the two employers. If you go into Milka, the employee was employee of DJ Nugent Company. Nugent assigned the plaintiff as a temporary employee over to the Falk Corporation. And he worked for Falk for approximately a little more than 3 months, and he worked on Falk premises. There was an arrangement ahead of time. The court has heard the Gansh case. The Gansh case is something that had a written lease, whereby a company sent a bulldozer operator down to Nakusa Paper. It doesn't matter which case you go in. If you get on to the one in Burnfen, you have a party who contacted a president of a company who determined that there would be an agreement to lend or borrow employees, and then it was worked on down from the top where the parties could also determine who is paying, who is handling Social Security disability, who is handling workers' compensation, who is providing the proper withholding Social Security taxes and the like. So in every case that you have, you've got people on the top that have some predictability, some opportunity to properly plan. I think the one case that the defense counsel indicated was a deviation from that was a Northern Trust case initially here. And I want to be clear on this because defense counsel was saying that the manager on his own went over to another farm. And if you take only one little excerpt of the case, that's what it says. But if you take a look at the entire case, it states on page 135, for many years there had been exchange of labor between the two farms. On page 136, it says, quote, when the work was being done on the Maytag farm, such directions as were necessary were given by Gilbert, the manager of the farm. When work was done on the Young farm, such directions as necessary were given by Reynolds, the manager of the farm. In other words, these two parties were managers. But even more telling is on page 138. Where the Supreme Court says, in applying the test to this case, it appears that Gilbert and Reynolds had made an arrangement for the exchange of labor by employees of their respective farms. Here's the part that is critical, that the respective owners had knowledge of the arrangement and approved same. In other words, even on the best case that the defense counsel could come up with, it clearly is in here that there was a past history of it, and the respective owners had knowledge of the arrangement, and they approved, or they consented. And that is true right on down in every single case except for this one. And I think what happened in this case is the Court of Appeals took a look at the test, and all of the other cases had already gotten over the issue while the parties knew and they consented. There was knowledge of consent by the employer, somebody calling up somebody else, they need to show up their hands. In this case, that wasn't present. And so Judge Magerson, who penned it, and the other two appellate judges came back and said, let's go back to the Seaman test and take a look at the Seaman test in its entirety. And didn't throw the Seaman test out, as defense has been arguing, actually took it in its entirety because some of the upfront information that was critical about knowledge and consent never occurred in this case. This is a case, and I put it before the Supreme Court here, is about a party that first makes this claim in an amended complaint. And if you went on the day that this happened and asked Monty Zeitzel, who is your employer, he would have told you it was Carla. He would have told you that it was. And you turn back 1 hour afterwards, he fills out a form and signs his name to it with the Wausau Police Department, and his employer isn't Major like he's claiming now. It's Corbin.
You agree that that's not dispositive, though, that most of loaned employees may very well put down their general employer as an employer.
But the critical information on there was about the accident that happened and what went on at that time. And this party put down, if you'd have asked him at that time, I would lay every last dollar I had that party would not have said, I consent to do this or anything else. This is something that is going on afterwards. And from a policy standpoint, our case law, and even the case law that's been proffered by this court, has actually addressed the issue of why we have to have more predictability, why we have to have more certainty in here. And I'll go to the...
Before you go to the next step, in Seaman, there's the test, and then there are the vital questions, as the court put them. And as you go through those, the first question is, did the employee actually or impliedly consent to work for a special employer? And in this case, the driver certainly was doing the work of Major or assisting in the work of Major, was he not?
Actually, he was assisting in the work that Major has. The contract that was there was for a contract to transport the load once it had been loaded.
But Major's responsibility to load it, was it not?
That's correct.
And that's what he was helping do at the time of the accident.
That's correct.
And then the next question was, whose was the work he was performing at the time of the injury? And you just told me that it was Major's work. And the third was, whose was the right to control the details of the work being performed? And how would you answer that question?
Well, on the third one there, that's the critical one, when you say pursuant to an express or implied contract. And what you don't have in this case is...
Well, it doesn't say that in the test and semen, though.
Let me just pull the test.
Okay, sure. If you've got the Wisconsin reports, it's on page 163.
Okay, you're talking about the vital questions?
Right.
And which question?
Well, I worked my way down to three, but if you want to go back to one and two, you can.
Okay. Well, number one, actually implying the consent to work for a special employer, I don't know how you can have unilateral consent. In this case, the party is saying I have unilateral consent. There were only employees there. There was a working foreman, Doug Brusewitz, and I can clarify this for the employer. Doug Brusewitz on page 21 of the affidavit that was initially presented at the first time for the motion for summary judgment from his deposition, and this is on page 20 of Mr. Brusewitz's deposition, says, there's a question, when you say they, who tells you this? Answer, well, my boss tells me. They get a hold of our guy up at Equipus. The job for us, a general contractor, or question. Okay, so a general contractor is the person telling your boss, and your boss is telling you. Right. Okay, that goes on. Oh, you don't get any specific instruction from your boss. It talks clearly about line of command that goes down from the top to the bottom, and this party is a working foreman. Almost every job that has employees out there working all the time needs somebody to kind of keep an eye on what the party is doing. He was not a supervisor. He was not a party that was allowed to hire anything else. And he's the only party that knew that this was going on. So what I'm saying and what the Court of Appeals says is that it's implicit in C-body that you have knowledge and consent. But in order to get that consent, you have to have a party that knows about it and offers you a job. And that did not happen in this case. So I don't think you had number one that was...
Well, it doesn't say it was the employer. It just says the employee, actually.
Right. But I'm saying that consent means I have to consent to something that is given to me. There was nothing given to him.
So you're saying that you can't simply, quote, volunteer in some way?
You can volunteer, but you're a volunteer at that point legally. You're not a
employee.
Right.
Right.
And the case law here, in fact, if you take a look at a lot of situations similar to this, they're deemed an employee. And that was what was indicated by the Court of Appeals. A school teacher who goes and does some food rationing that is adjacent to her job. That's a volunteer situation, and that's what has been determined by the state of Wisconsin, and that's where this case is. And the other party, the other case that was talking about regarding presumptions, the Scornia case. In Scornia, you had a crane operator that actually worked for an entire day for a special and never left, for legal purposes, never left his general employment or overcame the presumption, even though it was close work, that he had ever left his general employment. And that was true even though there were minimal directions that were given to him in that case relative to certain directions of what to do on the job. So on top of the lack of consent because nothing was given to him, we don't have a party that has overcome that presumption. But did I answer your questions, or do you want me to...
No, I think that answers. So your position is it would have to be somebody who was in a management position at least to offer...
Well, if you're going to have, the law is here for an orderly society. If you're going to have an orderly society...
I'm not arguing with you. I want to know what it is. What parameters, if you were to describe...
You'd have to have somebody that had the authority to hire or fire that would be arranging this, and it could either be the president or somebody at the president had given that authority.
What about the foreman?
The foreman is a working foreman who basically tells the crew that... We need to do this at this time because any crew needs a working foreman. That party is not supervisory, does not come around and tell parties what to do. They follow out the orders of what a supervisor has told them, and the supervisor is told by management people. So you are at the lowest rung that you can possibly get. And that party would not be the one that would have the authority to hire and fire, or even the authority to...
That's what you're arguing, but is there a part of the record that you can point to support what you're just saying?
There's never been a case on this where...
No, the record of this case to establish what the Brusewitz's authority
was. Brusewitz was the working foreman, took his directions from a boss that got it from somebody above them. And the working foreman, or the working foreman was stated and given his first page or second page of his deposition, and then the line of command down for the jobs that he had and his authority was what I just read to you on page 20 of his deposition.
Was Sissel at the time doing something that he was not designated to do? He was a truck driver.
So the contract was for the transportation, and the record is replete that at no other time had any other truck driver ever been involved in the loading process. The truck driver had the duty to transport the load once it was loaded and had the duty to go up on the load and secure the load and put a tarp on the load. So the truck driver, what happened in this case, essentially, I don't know how many the facts the court has, you have an individual that had called and was told that the load wasn't ready due to inclement weather. He came before he was called back on his own in mid-morning on Monday and waited until that thing would go. And he waited a couple hours and had a windshield replaced, and at that time, he wanted to get out of there. And there's a lot of people in here that talk about that. In fact, even the conduct of the parties is that they worked through the lunch break. Michael Giovannone said that that he was in a rush to get to Georgia. Michael Giovannone, and I can read it to the court, also indicated that the driver talked about being in a rush. The employees grumbled a little bit. They were the only employees from Major that were required to work through the lunch break. And, in fact, you had four employees there to do the work. The position that Jason Borman was in at the time this happened was a position that nobody else had ever been in because all you normally use are four people. They had four people there.
What did Sissel start doing about loading the truck?
Sissel started determining or placing or helping on the final placement of crates that were being put on with the forklift, and then he was grabbing boxes of extrusions, aluminum extrusions that weighed approximately 200 pounds, and there were approximately 20 of those boxes up on the load that were unsecured up for a distance on the back of about 6 feet and on the front of about 3.5 to 4 feet. And when the very last box was being put on, then the load went. And, I mean, every time when you look at a case, you might say, well, the party was just helping out a little bit. But you have a party here that wanted you going at that time, was pushing people, and they appeased him, apparently, to do this in inclement weather. They were in a hurry at the time that it went on, and they did not properly secure that load as they went ahead and did it. And it was, on compounding this, was the fact that it was the first time that they had done a double load, which meant that spacing and the distance things had to go up was going to be different. And you throw all those things together, you have all the ingredients of trouble, and that's exactly what you had here, and the party that was in the middle of that was the driver. And when these two rolls went, the back went at the same time the front, and the only party that had access to the back roll was the driver. Nobody else could reach it by the way and manner in which it had been piled in there. And the only party that could quite frankly watch and make sure it was put in well was the driver. Nobody else could even see it. So I think that's why the circuit court said that they were dead in the water, negligence or something else. But that isn't the issue here today. The issue is can a party come in unilaterally and claim that they are a lone employee and basically after the fact say, now because of that, we don't have a duty here and hop out underneath the exclusive remedy provision. Let me go into the policy areas very briefly. The three things I think the court should really look at in here in regards to why things should be done or why decisions should be made from a policy standpoint. One of the things that has been talked about is the extensive litigation that results from the lone employee case. There should be more predictability and certainty to it so we don't have all the litigation that we have. The case that addressed that area was the Hanch case, and Gansh on the bottom of page 750, and I'd like to read it because I think it's real helpful for where this court's going. This was actually language from the Supreme Court. The Seaman four-part fact-oriented test has proven problematic. More than once, this court has expressed dissatisfaction with the test, declaring this court, as well as others, that found the question of a lone employee troublesome. The definition and the factual essentials necessary to establish the legal relationship of a lone employee are not uniform in all of the reported cases, nor is the same emphasis always to the necessary elements. And that when applied to specific factual situations, distinctions are sometimes slight, decisions are well nigh irreconcilable. And then the point after that is critical. The Seaman test was unsatisfactory because its requirements were too manipulable, allowing litigation to flourish as employees and the courts have expended time and resources on suits turning on the lone employee issue. Every case that comes along is as long as a bank vault because we have a lone employee defense. You've got this case is no different. There's no end to the amount of litigation that you have on unless there is some definite, predictable type of case. And this one here falls beyond the farthest extreme with somebody that is unilaterally claiming it. The second area is in regards to certainty. And this court in DePratt and Sergio indicated the following. I think it's helpful. On page 146 of that case. Certainty and precision in its approach is desirable for the business practices of both borrowing and loaning employers. Employers can then prepare for what is necessary relative to financial and business needs, insurance, and other contracts. It doesn't make any sense to have somebody out there doing what they want, saying what they want, when the employers don't know about it, the employers can't plan. They can't plan to have proper insurance, proper medical needs, proper things that they would have and like. If somebody is out there doing what they want, when they want, and they're the only party that knows about it. The Milka case talks about the number of things that were done once the parties know about this, and they went through all the different kinds of insurance and the like. In this case, and the law and the body of law, has always been careful to try to give people certainty. If you have a contract, there's offer and acceptance. In this case, we have no offer. We have no request for the party to be loaned by the general employer, no knowledge of it by the general employer, and we have no additional compensation for this particular work, directly or indirectly. And even with all these things going on, we still have this defense, and we still have, as I've indicated, 2 years delay in getting this case through, and this isn't the only one that's like this. There's a lot of them.
Now, Miss, your opposing counsel objected to the Court of Appeals on the ground that he read the Court of Appeals as saying that there had to be a contract between the general and special employer relating to the loaned employee, and that there had to be a contract between the special employer and the special employee. How do you read that? I gather from your discussion, you think that there has to be some way.
There has to be some kind of knowledge and consent so that the employers can properly plan. And the Seaman test does talk about an express or implied contract. You can't get a unilateral contract or get consent when you don't have some party that is offering. In this case, there's no showing that anybody's offering. In fact, the uncontested evidence, even from Monty Zeitzel, is that nobody offered for him to work.
There was discussion here about the industry and practices in the industry. Is there any discussion in the record that on previous occasions there's been a loan by Corwin of an employee to Major?
There has never been a Corwin. There's no past practice to support this. This is the only time that a truck driver from any company, according to Major, has ever gone and assisted in the loading. So there's no past practice, as was the case in a number of other ones that we cited, including this Northern Trust.
Now, the other objection that opposing counsel had to the Court of Appeals was that the issue is, did the special employee have control over the employee, whereas the Court of Appeals seemed to indicate control over the job was the important aspect?
Well, I don't know if there's case law directly on that. The Court of Appeals says that there has to be some control of an employee by the general employer, and that's what I think is troublesome, hopefully, for this court, and it's troublesome, I think, to the Court of Appeals. There was no knowledge or involvement of them in any way for the loaning of this particular party. And if you don't have the right to control that, you don't have some orderly control of business or of employees if they go off and do what they want to do. And if the court allows this, the court is encouraging people to not follow the rules of what their employer tells them and doesn't give the certainty and predictability or allow the employers the ability to plan for the respective rights and duties that they have. I mean, you're moving to chaos, not to some sensibility in this particular matter.
Well, counsel, you quoted from several cases, and they were all unanimous cases, and all of them sort of complained a little about the test, the Seaman test, that it doesn't provide certainty and predictability. And yet in each of these cases, the court stuck with the Seaman test and denied and refused to accept a different test because that court thought would be even more troublesome. So what do you recommend that this court do to avoid these cases arising and to give predictability and certainty?
Well, the first thing I would do is I would require that both employers have knowledge and consent. And this would be true for the general as well as the special. If both of those parties do not have knowledge and consent, then they can't properly plan. And that only makes sense.
I think that's unclear under the Seaman test right now.
Well, the Seaman test, I think that is unclear, and I think that the Court of Appeals says it's implicit in it when it talks about express or implied contract, but I think at a minimum that should be stated so that we can get away from at least that area, and if that was the case, we wouldn't even be here today. As far as
of the two employers, who do you say did not have information and give consent?
Neither one.
Didn't Colvin send the man over there as a truck driver?
They sent him over to transport the load, not to assist in the loading.
So the
interesting thing about this case is that the trailer is the property of Colvin, and the driver has the right to be up there to secure the load and to put a tarp on that. In fact, he did secure the front half of the load and would have just about been ready to secure the back half, and then I'm assuming put the tarp on.
So is your argument that he's doing only what his employer knowingly sent him over there for?
He was doing more than his employer knowingly sent him over there for. And his employer didn't know that. And that's been conceded here in court, and that's never been an issue. His employer had no idea what he was doing.
You know, one of the anomalies with the loan employee test is that the employer who doesn't know and doesn't consent has liability, and the one who does consent and says to his employee, go ahead, you can work for Major and agrees with Major, then protects himself from liability by virtue of the workers' comp.
The law would place a duty on an employer to properly instruct, train, and supervise the employees to do what they were told to do, and would not encourage them or allow them to profit by not doing that and not being accountable for it. That's all I'm asking in this case, which I think makes sense.
I don't know how that fits the situation. If in this case, the employer, the general employer, had said to Major, it's all right if you use our employee, it's fine with us, and Major said fine, and then what happened here, the Colvin would have no liability whatsoever, right?
If the employers knew about it, had knowledge and consented, then they would have the ability between themselves to properly plan for it, and we wouldn't be where we're at here today. But in this case,
what do you mean plan for it? They would be protected?
Well, they could. If they said, all right, we are going to do this, then we are also going to either have a lease between us like we had in Gantz, or a contract as we've had with the temporary agencies in Milka, or...
The Colvin wouldn't have to do any of that, would it? Colvin would just simply say, we're agreeing to this, and Major, you can use them if you want, and then if something happens, workers' comp will be the sole remedy.
If the parties went ahead and worked it out ahead of time so that it could be done in a logical fashion, I would agree with you. If they wanted to play that game, then they could...
They could do that under the test, right?
They could do that arguably under the test, except that if it is done in that fashion, at least both parties know about it in advance, and both of them can make sure that it is properly accounted for, and they can instruct their employees or address it. I mean, in this case, you don't have any grounds for the employers to even know what's going on.
You don't, let me ask it, with regard to your implied contract, express or implied contract, are you suggesting that there has to be a discussion with regard to the implied contract, discussion between the employers beforehand, or is an acquiescence in custom in the profession sufficient?
I'm saying that there has to be knowledge, which would mean that they would have some idea. If it's custom in the business, they're put on notice. In some way, they have to have notice, whether that's done through implied or express contract or custom. We don't have any of those going on here. Now, let me get back to one other question, which had to do with what I reference as accountability in this case. I think this is a case that has a number of competing facets on it. If you look at the purpose of workers' compensation and an indication about why a party could do this or do that, and then perhaps they could fall under the event and semen test, and that's true, they could. But if you don't have accountability for what parties are doing, then basically you have no check on deregulation. I think this case is a byproduct of deregulation. You have truckers that are out there doing it not on a per-hour basis or not. They're out there doing it on a per-job basis. The faster that load gets down there, the faster they get back, the sooner they get paid, and they're on to another load. And that encourages people to hurry and make decisions that are detrimental to the safety.
My problem with it is that the employer, the general, the corpsman in this case, would have to do nothing other than say, all the people that are loading our trucks, they can use our drivers, and they are loaned employees. And the companies that are doing the loading could simply say, we want to use your employees. And the only remedy then for the injured employee is a workers' comp. And there doesn't have to be any special training. It doesn't matter how negligent they were, because the workers' comp embodies that. So,
and that's why I believe it was the Mecca case. I believe that Attorney Davis of Habish Davis and Rotier had argued that there should be a dual liability approach, and this court rejected it, and the dual liability approach would essentially avoid the problem that you're talking about there. And that's why he argued that, which is another consideration for the court, because that can get away from the game plan. Were there any other questions the parties had? Getting back to what I guess I have to stop here.
You can summarize in two short sentences.
Pardon?
I said you can summarize your argument or have a conclusion in two short sentences.
Let me do that.
One of them had a lot of semicolons.
Let me do it.
You don't have to. If you don't
want to. Right, or you can sit down.
There's one statement that was made by the Court of Appeals that I would just like to pass on, and that was, casual, unplanned, uninvited participation by Zeitzel in the loading of Major's product on Corbin's truck represents a minor deviation from the usual tasks performed for his regular employer and not a shifting of control over Zeitzel from Corbin to Major's.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Strand, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to address a couple of issues that the justice has put to both Mr. Foker and myself. One question was raised concerning Mr. Brusewitz's abilities or powers on behalf of Major Industries. In pages 22 through 24 of our brief, we quote extensively from Mr. Brusewitz's deposition, and he is talking in terms of when Mr. Sisdell came to work for him and what he was doing, and as part of that testimony on page 117 of his deposition, I believe, it indicates, and initially there were just the four of you, correct? And at this point he's referring to Mr. Sisdell, the driver for Horwin, himself, Mr. Sala, and Mr. Giovannoli. And he goes on to say, because he was there, or else I would have had another person come out from the shop there, and you didn't. I didn't because he said he would help us. He did what you told him to do. Yes, he did. Then Mr. Sala, who's another employee out there, responded on that same page, Who came and got you to load the truck? Doug. Doug did. All right. And when Doug came and got you, who else did he get? Mike G. And yourself. Right. And at that time, Doug didn't ask for anybody else to come, did he? Not at that time. Okay, so at that point, it wasn't that you brought a fourth person out and the truck driver said, I'll help, and then somebody went back in. You just never brought... When you were brought out, it was just the three of you, correct? What we have is Mr. Brusewitz deciding who's going to work on this project. He goes into the shop, he gets three people because he already has Mr. Sisgo, and he brings them out to load, or two people in the shop, to load the truck. He is a managing supervisor. Call him a working foreman, call him the boss. He's the guy who decides who's going to work on this truck, who's going to load this truck. His deposition testimony is absolutely crystal clear. He decided who's going to load this truck. So it is management involved here. The second issue that was raised concerned unilateral consent. I think that's what Mr. Folker called it, unilateral consent. This isn't unilateral consent. Again, what's significant here, Mr. Sisgo came out and loaded the first half of the truck. There was a break at that point. The truck, the first half was strapped down. That's the way they did it. He then went back and loaded, as the fourth member of this team, the second half of the truck. There were two loading enterprises here. It would be as if there were two trucks side by side. They loaded one. They didn't bring somebody else out to load the second one. They didn't tell Mr. Sisgo to go sit in his truck. They didn't do anything except to say, good, come and help us load the second truck. And that's what Mr. Brusewitz said. I didn't because he said he would help us. And that's what he did. So it isn't unilateral consent, it's bilateral consent. Mr. Sisgo consented, and Major Industries consented through Doug Brusewitz and through what happened out there. The third issue this court raised concerned trade practices. There is testimony in the record concerning trade practices. Mr. Folker is correct that at no time in the past had Corwin Transport driver worked at Major Industries in loading a truck. It's because they never had a contract with one another before, so it's obvious they never would have had this situation arise previously. Doug Brusewitz testified, however, that while they had not had a driver help load a semi before, they had drivers help load flatbeds before. So this is not something that was unusual in the industry. And in fact, Mr. Sisgo testified that in the past, he'd been asked for other employers in other situations.